inhaling these chemicals, these toxins, and how they affect our bodies, and especially how they're affecting children. We see so many young teenagers and kids that are hospitalized on ventilators in the ICU after vaping. And just yesterday here in New York, the health department issued an advisory warning linking vaping with severe lung damage. So something's going on, and we definitely have to tackle it because, you know, it's an epidemic that's growing.
Now, regarding those protests going on, parents and other advocates say that fruit and candy-flavored e-cigs contribute to addiction and underlying health issues. For more news, find us online at usaradio.com. For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Okay, so let's do a sound test. This is Joe Peters, and I'm talking with Eric Moore. Eric, say Eric Kober. I have an Eric Moore I talked to yesterday. Eric, so say hello.
Hello, how are you?
Great. So we're going to get started in probably 3 minutes. Once we get through the few commercials they asked me to play, we'll be right back. Thank you.
This is Georgine Trinkle. I want to invite you to listen to Hot and Hunterd In every Monday from 4 to 5 p.m. You'll be treated to discussions on hot topics every week. Hot and Hunterd In provides a more in-depth look at issues that are happening right now. You can catch the show live and call in on what matters to you. Make sure to download the podcast to catch up on all our hot topics.
So, hey, it's Joe Peters. We're broadcasting from scenic downtown Flemington, New Jersey. It is exactly 4:06 p.m. on Tuesday, the 21st, isn't it? The 20th. It is the 20th of July. Man, we're coming to the end of the summer and gangbusters. They've asked me to give you the weather report, so I'm using my handy Android weather system. And it says it's 88, it feels it, it's muggy. It is going to go down to 70 tonight, 91 tomorrow, some rain, looks like a little rain overnight as well. 70 tomorrow night again, 88 on Thursday, still some more rain, then it breaks. We're back down to 77, and probably going to wind into the end of summer. I always say by around the 15th of August, you probably can just about shut the air conditioner off, and I think we're getting close. We actually had a pretty nice week a week before last. It got cool, and that's sort of unseasonably cool. I'm going to play a few more commercials, and we'll be right back.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR-DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
Join the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce.
One of the biggest decisions in your lifetime is buying or selling a house. Choosing a realtor with strong client communication, technology, and marketing skills will dramatically improve your chance of success. That's why Hunterdon and Somerset's residents rely on Joe Peters. Joe believes his clients deserve a smooth and seamless experience, not a roller coaster ride. As a Coldwell Banker sales associate with 20 years of experience, he's helped hundreds of people to achieve their goals and dreams, no matter where they were in the buying or selling process. Joe accomplishes this by approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, he tries to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them his own. Then he takes the mass amount of data that's available and distills it down to a few understandable action points. And finally, he controls the entire process through technology and marketing. The end result to you is a smooth, rewarding customer experience. Let Joe show you how to take his professional expertise and put it to work for you. To contact Joe, go to jpeters.com or call 908-238-0118.
Next 1984.
So it's Joe Peters back, and with Eric Kober, K-O-B-E-R is the way you spell your name?
Yes, sir.
And Eric, as a veteran, I always like to thank veterans for serving. You served up until when?
23 June, actually, so pretty fresh retirement.
Wow, of this year?
Yep.
And how many years altogether in the military?
23 June actually made 23 years.
Isn't that so? Why did you stop there?
That's a great question. So it's not exactly as I had it planned, but I was in medical retirement actually.
Right.
And so, you know, I was an aviator while I was in the Army. I flew Apaches, which was exactly what I wanted to do. Supporting the infantry fight, the ground fight, and 20 plus years I flew helicopters. It takes, you know, a physical all the way back to 1996. That was my first flight physical, and nothing ever mentioned. Perfect physical condition. And in about, about 2009, it was the first time I'd heard something that sounded a little different. And they said, I think you might have athlete's heart. I said, what's that? Is that good? It must be good, right? It's athlete's heart. You're strong. No, so it could be bad. So it's an over-muscling of your heart. And, you know, sure enough, they did some further tests and whatnot. And ultimately that ended for me in a medical retirement.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was...
So at 23, I mean, that includes West Point?
23 years? No, it doesn't.
So you're at a West Point at about 23, 24, plus 20 something. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're just around 50. You're a young man yet.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Look at all the time. I mean, if I'm in my 70s, look what you got ahead of you. So you're like
sure enough.
The first day of the rest of your life. It's
yeah.
exciting.
Yeah,
it's
and I draw back. I still remember even at my retirement ceremony, you know, all the things flood through your mind. And I very well remember thinking when I was a younger man, hey, I could probably retire at 42 if this works out right. So right. there I was. I was 45. Again, I think I retired a little bit earlier than what I would have liked to, but I don't believe anything's a coincidence. So I'm really excited about the next chapter. You know, I have no regrets. I served and served well, and thankful to be sitting here today in many of the things that I served in. You know, I like to say I want to continue to serve those who serve today, just in a different capacity.
Once again, on behalf of everybody, thank you for serving. How did you know you wanted to go to West Point? When did you first know?
Oh, that's a story. So it goes back to fifth grade, if you
okay.
can believe it. So I grew up in a little town, Hohokus, New Jersey. We talked. I know you're familiar with
pretty
it.
Pretty upscale, though.
Yeah, but very a tight-knit close community, not what you would typically
right.
think of as New Jersey. So we were up to West Point on a football weekend, and with my parents in the car. I'm sure you can all visualize it. Mom and Dad up there listening to the music they want to listen to, and you don't want to listen to any of it.
Yeah.
So you've got your earphones on, and you're listening to something else. And my mom turned around. I was obviously looking out the windows, like, this is a pretty amazing place. And right about this time, there's a few things going on. My mom turns around, looks at me, and says, Eric, how would you like to go to a place like this? And my wheels were already turning at this point.
Right.
And I'll tell you, I was not the perfect student. I was not your ideal young man at the time. I spent a lot of time in the hallway, I'll say. And,
walking down to that dreaded principal's
office. Yes, yep, sure enough. Dr. Woodbury was his name, and Mrs. Hubin spent a lot of time with me in that fifth grade. But she asked me that question. And what came out of my mouth next was, you know, Mom, I think... And before I could even really answer, Dad turned around. He's driving.
Yeah.
Takes his eyes off the road, and he goes, well, Eric, the way you're going right now, this is the only way you're going to see this place. A football weekend in the back seat.
Okay.
Driving along. So, I mean, that was a challenge
yeah.
right there. Dad
yeah.
really and that changed. That was a transformational comment. Because I recognize that there's really only two paths I can go.
Yep.
One I'm on that, to me, wasn't what I wanted to do, and or this other path that ultimately could lead to something, as I saw it, the ideal in values that I could get. So, and the funny thing was, in that same time, there were two cadets walking, and they were walking down the street towards what was the old PX, the old post exchange, place where you go buy things.
Yep.
And they were walking in step. I was like, why? Why did they need to do that? Like, nobody's watching. Nobody's
right.
telling them to do that. But they were walking in step together. And that still sticks in my mind as, you know, the do what's right when nobody's looking.
Yep.
Thing that West Point stood for in my mind at that time in fifth grade. The interesting thing is I didn't get accepted the first time either.
Wow.
So I went to Midland Park High School. I applied early action, everything. Sent, you know, every couple weeks I sent a letter to the admissions officer. And sure enough, I got no letter like most folks did until about 2 months before reception day, which is when everybody comes in. Saying that you have acceptance to the Military Academy Prep School, which at that time was down in Fort Monmouth, New Jersey.
Okay.
And sure enough, I got accepted to that. Later, I find out talking to my admissions officer had a lot to do with my diligence and keeping him updated. He said my packet was really thick. So when he put it up on the desk as they're going reviewing all these files, it was impressive to that committee that I was so diligent. And sure enough, 10 months later, I found myself in the class of 1997 at West Point.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. 1997 West Point. So we're talking 07, 70, we're talking 22, that's 23 years.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And when you go to West Point, and I've never understood this, I wanted to go to the Air Force Academy, and I wanted to become a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to a high school thing where they had the guys from the Air Force Academy come in and say, look, back in the day, I think he meant it, but it wasn't really strict. That, you know, all we ask for you after 4 or 5 years at the academy is 20 years of your life. It's a commitment.
Hmm.
And I said to myself, two things. One, my eyes weren't good enough. I didn't realize that. Today I could have flown, but I couldn't then.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I wasn't sure I was ready to give 20 years of my life to Uncle Sam. I want 20, that's just sounded like a lot. So between the two, I never pursued it. If I did, I'd probably be out of work in Wichita, Kansas, because the time I went through what became pretty hard times for a lot of the industry. Mm-hmm. But I've always been envious of the people and to watch and to see the disciplines. Even when my son went in the Navy, rank and file Navy, when we went to see him after 8 weeks, he was a changed man.
Absolutely.
And it never came out of him. It was always there. So that military experience in Maryland, who worked for the divorced the mother of my children, she, the woman I'm with today, went through the FBI. So she has that work discipline of if you're not there 15 minutes early, you're late, and you don't click a day off, I don't give you sick, get into work. And
right.
You don't see that in people anymore.
Right. Right.
So when you go to West Point, do you get the chance to choose what you're going to take?
Actually, really do. I went in. My father was an infantry officer, served in Vietnam, came back, actually served at St. Peter's College as an ROTC instructor there. And going into West Point, I wanted nothing more than to be my dad. And I mean nothing more in that was the aspiration, was to be an infantry officer. But as I got to the academy after a couple of years, certainly of summer training and within the military science and tactics realm, I learned that there's 16 other branches. They bring so much to that infantryman on the ground that's fighting. Oh, by the way, that infantryman is equally supported by armor formations and field artillery and air defense and everything that that brings to bear on the enemy. I recognized my second summer that I wanted to be an aviator.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. And not just any aviator. I wanted to fly an Apache. I wanted to fly that tank in the air.
So that's a big helicopter.
It is.
I just don't know how big it is.
It is. I get shivers still just saying it. It's about anywhere from 17,500 to 21,000 pounds, depending on what you have on it. Yeah, so it's a. It
and
is.
How many men can it carry?
Two.
Two.
Yep.
So
it's just two. It has the pilot in the back seat, and then the co-pilot gunner is in the front.
And so it's a transportation vehicle for carrying things.
Armament alone. Yep.
So what division did that break down to? That was the armament delivery division, or
logistics? No? So the way aviation is broken down in the early 90s, aviation reconfigured itself, and so there's attack helicopter battalions. So several of those are distributed across the country at the different installations. My first assignment was at Fort Bragg. At that time, they had two attack helicopter battalions for what was the 229th Attack Helicopter Regiment. And at that time, it was supporting this idea called the deep attack at the core headquarters level. So it really was its own separate entity. And our main focus and mission was to attack and destroy, you know, really deep within enemy lines if we needed to. And, it was the armored tank formation that was at the basis of that, because the battalion could.
What's the last time you flew then? Was it in the last 12 months of service?
No. Okay. So, part of my story, 2009 was my last flight. It was my second deployment to Iraq. I didn't know at that time it was my last flight, but it would be. And so from there, I went to what was called an intermediate level education experience for the field grade as a major at the time.
Yeah.
And that's up in Fort Leavenworth. And what I found at Fort Leavenworth, a couple things. One, I found my passion for business there. I actually got my MBA at night. While we were going to school during the day, 2 days a week, I would go to night school to learn about this little bug within me that hadn't yet matured. But I realized I had a passion for it. And then also I found out that I really wanted to be a strategist, an operational planner within the military. And there was an application process, and so I decided in that beginning of the first year that I would apply for this thing and see if I could get it. It was called the School of Advanced Military Studies, and I did. I had no idea that it would be the educational experience that it was. And so that really was a transformational time for me as a lifelong learner, really with a zest for complexity. You know, Simon Sinek calls it, you know, the infinite game, which is life. I really came out the other side of that very quickly to go to my third deployment to Iraq, but with a set of tools that was like no other that I had been given in the Army. So
you acquired skills between your education and your experience that nobody in the business world would have on their own. There's nowhere place else in the world to get them.
I think that's fair to say. That's fair to say.
Of skills put together to say, I mean, sometimes I say to people, I never served, as I said earlier, but I wish I had, and I'm not staying up late thinking about it, but, you know, I really wish I had, and I've always appreciated people did. And Marilyn's cousin went to Vietnam, and he became a helicopter pilot, and Ronnie used it till he came back and flew commercial for AT&T until he was 60, and it was a mandatory retirement at that point in time. I don't know if it's still the same age. Did very well in life for him. But how many guys learned to fly? He said, you go over there, and 2 weeks later, poof, you're a helicopter flyer. But today, it's quite a lot more training than it was at wartime, I would imagine.
Yeah. Well, and there's still, I mean, many of my peers have done just that. You know, when they transition out of the military, they may not even necessarily fly. I do have a couple friends that are very passionate about flying, but some go direct into the program management of the same airframe development programs that ultimately supported them when they were aviators. So the big contracting side of the Army is still there and, you know, and healthy.
So those skills are still required.
Absolutely. And who better than somebody that's had 15 or 20 years within the field flying to go, what does this future vertical lift thing look like? And what should it look like from the aviator perspective? What relieves some of that stress that we had as young aviators?
Who made your helicopter? There used to be Sikorsky.
So there's McDonnell Douglas. Boeing still has their hands in there. There's several. Sikorsky certainly does still have their hands within the community, and they compete. You know, it's a very competitive.
So I worked when I was selling mechanisms, and that's stuff that goes into stuff, and it was signature capture. And we worked on a project with Lockheed Martin and I guess it was Boeing. It was McDonnell Douglas, and I know Lockheed Martin because they were in Atlanta, and everyone must have been Boeing.
Yep.
And it was such a big project for both because this was in a great big project. I was working on 1/2 of 1/100 of 1% of it. And the winner had to subcontract the loser because the loser would go out of business after developing that much. And I've never heard of that logic before.
Yep. I said, wow. No, it happens quite often. Yeah. And even within the airframes that are currently fielded, just like you said, McDonnell Douglas may have certain aspects. I mean, the engines we have are GE engines in the Apache. I don't think all the airframes have GE. But certainly it takes a village of that expertise to make that aircraft what it is today.
And why should somebody lose just because somebody was a little more?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So what countries did you serve in? Or what?
I really only had two primary installations that I was as a force providing unit. Right. So I was in Fort Bragg for two tours locally, and then I was out of Fort Hood. the center of that. So I have Fort Bragg, Fort Hood, and Fort Bragg.
Okay.
Across those locations, I deployed out of Fort Bragg three of what I would consider my five times. So I went to Bosnia in 1999, which was really my first blueing experience. I was a young captain. Mm-hmm. It was really a great experience. I had great leadership. It was a great opportunity to see what imminent danger looks like without being fully immersed in what an Iraq or Afghanistan ended up being.
What is bluing? What does bluing stand
for? So like the bluing of a weapon. Okay. Is that is the hardening and tempering of the metal that's in that's within, and it allows you to continue to shoot.
So Bosnia was number one.
Straight, yep. So Bosnia was my introduction, and things were pretty settled there. Some like to say it was a flying club because there wasn't a lot going on. We were going to look at things. My next was really probably the most transformational for me as a leader in Afghanistan in 2002. So it was post 9/11, mm-hmm. And we were basically the next aviation task force after the 101st had gone in. Conventionally speaking. And then from there, I had three subsequent deployments to Iraq. So in 05, I was actually within a ground unit as an aviator, as a liaison for planning for them. That was with 4th Infantry Division, mm-hmm. the 2nd Brigade. And then in 2008, I subsequently went as a flyer. I was an operations officer there. So I was able to really plug into a battalion and be flying quite a lot. And then my third deployment was as an operational planner in 2011. We actually were the team that shut down combat operations in Iraq in December.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was a great diversity in the experiences I had. You know, I was with an infantry BCT in that first deployment to Iraq. I had time as a full-fledged aviator in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And then that last one, you know, really the strategy and operations that go into the planning of combat ops was.
So let me just take Afghanistan in a non-political question, mm-hmm. okay? Because I've watched Afghanistan since I've been alive, I guess, because I remember the Russians got annihilated. I forget how many people got killed there. Mm-hmm. But then my earliest next memory was that Obama wanted to accelerate Afghanistan, and mm-hmm. even before he was in, it was going to be Afghanistan. And then we go for this political bullshit that you can't really tell what's the truth here as a citizen as to what's going on. But now I'm hearing in the last day that, we're going to pare down we're at 14,000 and make it down to 9,000, but we're never going to leave, and we're talking to the Taliban. I don't know why the hell we're talking to the Taliban. I just don't understand it well enough. But it seems like, because I've watched the whole series that Ken Burns did on Vietnam, it seems such political bullshit goes on that gets back to your ears. You can't tell what's going on over there. And then the icing on the cake was this woman who ripped the woman from California apart on the debate 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Mm. And she's apparently, I don't know if she's a colonel or she's major, I think she is, Tulsi something. And she was saying, we should shut down Afghanistan. Too many people have died. I'm saying, first of all, I don't know how you know that, okay, and why you would say that. But what is your opinion of it? I mean, after being there and seeing what's going on, is it something that will ever end? I don't want a political opinion.
Well, it's a good question. And it's a question for 17 years I've had to wrestle with and come to grips with as an officer. I've had to explain it to my soldiers and look them in the eyes as to why we're doing what we're doing. I've lost very dear friends to the fight that we've been fighting. And the question, I guess the ethical question to come back to is it a moral and sound reason that we're at war? And I go back to thinking about what 9/11 was to me. Right. And I very vividly remember coming into work that morning, looking up at my TV and seeing literally this attack unfolding before our eyes.
Right.
And so there was no question in my mind when the call came 6 months later, is this a moral fight we have on our hands as a nation, that it was indeed. Now, the questions of politics and who serves who, very clear to me as a military member, when I was a military member, that we ultimately serve the political objective. And it's often not for us to say, though certainly the senior leaders or 3- and 4-star generals are doing their best to advise that.
Right.
It ultimately comes down to the commander-in-chief and his cabinet and his staff to make that determination. I think where we run into the challenge is when we don't have all the information at our hands. And so, like, as you were saying that, I mean, what I was thinking was, man, if Dr. Kalenda could be sitting right here next to me, Chris is, yeah. And we'll talk about that later, but Strategic Leaders Academy, he's the founder and franchisor that I've taken under as my franchise. He has done so much work with the Afghan people, with the politics there, with American leaders, to try and help them to see the full picture.
Right.
And so I'd be interested to know how he might answer your question.
Interesting.
And
it's probably an unfair question. I'm just curious.
It's a hard question, particularly for me, because the information pulls me in multiple directions.
Right. I'm seeing your friends die.
You know, it's you become very...
What the fuck are we doing? Excuse me, I'm not allowed to say that anymore. What the hell are we doing here?
You become very attached to it.
Yeah.
But as I step back and look, you know, is this the same quagmire, if you will, to use the term, that Vietnam was? Right. It's certainly not the same, but... You know, are there some similarities that we could have avoided?
And if you look at the politics, I have a funny feeling we're going to do this in two parts because we're halfway done.
Yeah, no problem.
But when you look at the Vietnam War, it started from the French, who owed us dearly, and always said that, from World War II, that screwed up Vietnam and still admit it to today. And then it went through 4 or 5 presidencies. Everybody took a chance of screwing it up even more. And we got out of there losing so many people from so many countries and solving nothing. It's just the same. Why did I go? I know we went to, as I said, we've studied World War II, and we went and did the Normandy invasion, and we went all the way across from on the most western side, St. Malo, all the way over to, what's the next country? Netherlands, I guess.
To the north. Right.
And I didn't realize, after studying this so many times, that in effect we dropped paratroopers in the night before to clear the way for these guys coming up the beach to go.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up. So this October, Chris is taking the team of us franchisees as well as some other leaders, and we're going to Normandy to visit. Because Staff Ride, just like you're sharing, history is so integral to helping us understand from different perspectives. And ultimately help us in our own challenge
the
that exists.
Church, which had the steeple that the guy's parachute got caught on in, it was the longest day, I think.
Yeah.
In St. Elysius or something like that. But they have a...
St. Mary Elise.
Right? That's it.
Yep.
The parachute's still hanging there. I remember walking up, not knowing the story, saying, why would they have this rag hanging from the roof? And then when they have this museum to the drones, not drones, but they were... gliders that
right,
were towed
the gliders.
In. Another thing
Absolutely.
I never learned about.
Oh, it's amazing.
They were bringing 30 men plus jeeps and cooking materials in and just leaving. I said, would they ever retrieve them? They intended to. They never did. The war just moved too fast.
Yep.
It's an amazing logistical story.
It is.
And then when we got into how they came along and took the dog, that they had another logistical cord that took care of the dead. They identified where they are, took one of the dog tags. I'm saying, my God. This is what you learn in war college, I guess, but we as people, just knowing we're fighting a war, never get this far into it.
Yeah.
But to sit through some of the graphical scenes and see what these guys went through, the one we watched on the landing at, I was on both beaches, but it was the landing at Iowa Beach or Omaha. It was in Normandy. What was the other big beach? Anyway.
Omaha
Beach. Yep. The guy's son, they all got to where they were under the bank and were shooting over the heads. They couldn't shoot down. He says, we've got to take this hill. That was Teddy Roosevelt's son. Teddy Roosevelt's son led him. Yep. He was a general. He got killed in the thing. Took him up the hill and took those guns out. And those guys got up and went. And we've driven through there, and just to see that the beaches today are resorts and people out there with umbrellas and bikinis, it seems like, my God, no, this can't be.
Yeah. You'd have to have about 10 shows to have Chris on, I think, because you guys would definitely hit it off in your conversations.
Wow.
For sure.
Well,
yeah.
I could have him as a calling guest, and we can do it one day.
Yeah,
so
no, I think he'd love it.
So yeah, you then took all of this experience and said, I'm not sure if you found Chris or Chris found you or if it was mutual, but you found this opportunity to use your experience in, I want to call it real life, but civilian life.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I was probably, I mean, 10 months to a year out from retiring, and I knew already that the retirement process was beginning. And I started trying to shape my own path. Because I certainly wanted to be proactive about it. I didn't want to, you know, find myself on the other side of retirement and not know what I was doing. And I really have a passion for leadership. As I told you, I had this found passion for business, but not the experience other than, you know, running some lawnmowers when I was a younger kid. And so one of the, I think, most critical things I found helpful to me in shaping my own future is hearing other people's journeys. And so I was calling people, cold calling. I was looking on Google to find, hey, what comes up when you type strategic leadership or consulting?
Right.
And Chris Kalenda's name came up. And you've seen his site, our site, the strategicleadersacademy.com. He really gears to the answer of whether it was mutual. I sought him out to hear his journey, and I think he saw in me the exact opportunity that I would realize in him in this franchise opportunity, because he realized I was where he was in 2014, about to go on this journey to develop my own content, to take leadership to the next level myself and formalize it in process and, you know, good narrative. And he'd already done that. I mean, 4 years of working with small businesses and nonprofits, and he had formulated really what equates to a great array of tools, whether it's persona quizzes, whether it's, you know, strategy development or assessment, whether it's staff rides, like I said, whether it is online digital courses, you can take that. Certainly comes with an array of coaching, but he had formulated this great package. And, I mean, who could not look at that and go, that's a great opportunity, because it's gonna catapult me into what I want to do.
Right.
And now I can get down and actually just have the conversations with people and build relationships and continue to serve those that are serving.
He sort of constructed the infrastructure from within you can start working.
Absolutely.
I remember I was IT director at Macy's Herald Square, and the president sat me down and said, do you want to get in a car and drive, or do you want to get in a car and say, wait a minute, I got to cut down some trees and pave the road? You know, it's two different ways of thinking. He said, I'm looking for drivers.
Okay.
Yep. So don't start telling me about the things I could have other people doing. We presume they're done. How do we start driving?
Yeah.
And that's what you were looking for. It's almost like divine intervention, Brooke.
It was. Because I thought I was going to have to cut down the trees, do everything, just like he had started in 2014. But his vision on that day was, I got something better.
Wow.
And his focus was to senior military leaders.
Wow.
Because
so
he knows what they come with.
So you're an MBA. He's a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I've done with two counties now, as I started to say before we got started, I spent a lot of years in the corporate world, all in IT. And it was like, to some extent, it's not a good analogy, but it was like fighting a war, because we had to change it from A to
really
B.
Is.
And we'd say, kiss the wife goodbye. You weren't going to see her for 6 or 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to war on this project to change a company structure. And the things that you go through were things that I always asked when I went into an interview. Tell me about the company's culture. Mm-hmm. I want to know about the company's culture.
Absolutely.
Tell me about where the leaders that are here came from and what their experience. I probably read up before I went for the interview. And you said you've got the three things. You've got the leadership, the culture, and...
Strategy.
Yeah. So my background, and I worked with the Big Eight, so we were with, they're not a Big Four or Five, but there mm-hmm. was Deloitte and Touche, Schindler's, Coopers and Lybrand and whatever, and they would sell not only accounting and audit, but they would also sell project management services. So when I was with SAP, which is the largest software, mm-hmm. we would align ourselves with them, and they would help us develop a plan to get from A to B. We'd call it an as-is. I always thought it was a waste of money. Sit down and document it as-is. But most of the people working in the company didn't understand what that was. They didn't understand what they did.
Absolutely.
They thought they understood, but they didn't.
Absolutely.
And then we had to be, okay, this is the to B, and we needed to then develop a plan from as-is to 2B, and that was quite a plan. And mm-hmm. sometimes I did J. Crew in New York City. It was a two-year plan, and mm-hmm. we took a company. And we always said we could take more, 2% of the annual basis. They can't afford to digest more than that. And we yep. did that right at the 2% mark of J. Crew on that project. And it was massive in the extent that we had an overall methodology that we followed. We had a strategic partner. In that case, it was, I think, Coopers. Might have been built. No, it was Deloitte. And then we had, so our own was the methodology, theirs was the strategy. And then mm-hmm. I learned, and I never understood what the difference was of a strategy and a tactic, but a tactic supports a strategy. A strategy
Absolutely.
Is strategical thinking.
Yep. Yep.
That the tactic, you may change tomorrow if today
yes.
didn't work.
Yes.
So,
and strategic planning in and of itself is a conundrum. The two... Planning supports the strategy, but
right.
strategy in the end is that competitive advantage
right.
that you're going to gain, and it has to be clear, it has to be understood,
yep.
and it has to be accessible. Like, you've got to get feedback to know whether your strategy is working. And when you get that, I how many pages was that product you got back when?
Oh, it was volumes.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and you certainly, no, if you didn't read it, guess what? Nobody else read it.
Right.
So at least the first two probably fall at the wayside, being clear and understandable.
We would discover that, A, the company wanted it just the way they ran. We said, no, we're putting in best practices. That's what you bought. You're mm-hmm. going to get best practices, and we'll modify it for you after 12 months of trying it. That's how we justified this problem, was your base, your current as is the best practices on cost savings.
Hmm.
Once we get the best practices, if you think you have a better way, and everybody thought they did, but they wound up they never did, we then will help you modify it. But that's probably after we step back out. Yep. That's up to you. You get to run your own ship. And some ran it into the grassland company. So I was always in routine telling, you're in restaurants. They're not that far apart,
right.
except
right.
the service aspect of restaurants is different than the service aspect of retail. You still got the inventory. You still mm-hmm. got the final product. Restaurants have gotten much more, especially with the minimum wage, structured as far as automation now.
Yep.
And
yep.
I belong to, you'd be welcome to come look at this group. I belong to a strategic, not a strategic, but a high net worth management group in Warren, New Jersey. We meet every Wednesday morning. And these guys talk about things. I feel gifted to be sitting at the table. I know what I'm doing.
I've been there. Not there, but
yeah,
I've been in that place.
And they're this one guy is saying that this one company just went under last week, was the first to fall for $15. They ironically identified the same cities that were the liberal cities that went to $15 an hour, and all of those cities going to $15 an hour took the company under.
Yep.
Because they couldn't justify their business model at $15
yep.
an hour.
And their strategies weren't flexible and agile enough. 12 months and you're dead.
Yeah.
It's no longer, you know, the world has become so much smaller
right.
and hotter with the connectivity that we have and
right.
networking, globalization. 12 months and you're done. Or you're at least completely changing out the leadership.
Right.
And accepting the loss.
Or KPIs, key performance indicators, to shoot
yep.
the red flag up that something's going wrong here. Pay
right.
attention here.
Right.
And you not only needed a guy to guide the ship, but you needed the guy looking down and saying, is the ship going in the direction?
Yep.
Enough of these and enough of these and enough of these to keep it going. So he became more of, although he was probably higher up the totem pole, he was more of a driver to make you stay on course, and you, and part of the plan, drove the ship. It is amazing how many people cannot conceive it takes that in business today. I met the guy who ran Hunter Medical Center. He's retired. And I could see by talking to that guy, and I did the Leadership Hunter program and the Leadership Somerset program. And through those programs, they put you one day a month through an industry. So when we went through healthcare, the guy's name's Bob Wise, and I could see this guy wasn't looking at people's eyes. He was looking at the tops of their heads. And I said, that's the kind of man you need to run a ship like this, because he was making sure you had enough in the supply chain. You had enough in here. You had enough over there. And he was not feeling the day-to-day, but he was looking at the long-term guidance of the project. And that's so sorely needed. And so most of the companies I've worked for, if not all, the president was the operations guy, and the CEO was the visionary. So the visionary would be him. Here, I'm taking him. But the president would start making these decisions. I need this. I remember Herb, I hope you're still alive somewhere. Herb Yurloff at Macy's in New York said, okay, you need $2.5 million to do this project next year. That means I need to sell $47 million more goods to get that kind of net margin on it. Got it. Gone. I'm not saying I'm improving. I just understand it. Those are the kind of people you start working with. You say, you're in a stratosphere.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm looking. I'm not even looking at the eyes. I'm looking at the shoes. And he's looking at tops of heads and getting funding for these projects.
Yeah.
So we're at 4:50. We've got about 7 minutes left. Talk about what a typical project for you in your new career looks like.
Well, so I've had all of 60 days under my belt, or actually about 45. But so honestly, I have not had a full-fledged project.
Okay.
So I've approached how I'm, as you mentioned, I'm really, my passion right now lies for the restaurateur, whether it's quick service, fast casual, even some of the more upscale restaurants, because what I've found in phase one, which is observation, that's what I've been doing. I just go around and I visit different restaurants, and I'll sit and I'll watch for 30 days. Had to bite my tongue to not say anything, really, other than, like, you know, small talk. But I was strictly there to understand the environment. And then I would leave. And that was hard for a month. I mean, other than my retirement, nothing's coming in. That's about what I'm doing. This second phase, I really call it One Bravo, I'm starting to engage now, talking to general managers and managers about the things that I saw, not necessarily at their restaurants, but in general. And I'm starting to ask them the questions. And what I've found is there's a lot of challenges. And it depends on the location. And certainly, I mean, we bring a lot of things to any one of those challenges, whether it's leadership, whether it's culture, whether it's strategy. We can tackle any and all of those. Or it could just be as simple as me coming and, you know, you want to pull the team together and have a little, you know, Q&A with a military guy.
Yeah.
I can absolutely do that and share, like, an Apache, you know, have multiple experiences that I could share that might give that team some inspiration, some thought towards accountability, towards discipline, towards, you know, all those things, like you said, that the military brings that you don't necessarily see outright in the community as a culture of excellence.
Yep.
And so, you know.
How did you pick the restaurant segment?
So that's probably a complete show in and of itself, but it really was actually competing to be an owner-operator at Chick-fil-A.
Okay.
And I saw, through that process, I felt like I was within somewhat of a military process, and it was fascinating, the process they put you through. It was almost as rigorous as, like, getting your security clearance in the Army. The questions they ask you, and, you know, that year 70,000 applicants signed up to say, I'm interested in owning a Chick-fil-A.
Yeah.
And so through that whole process, I really grew to recognize that community, not just Chick-fil-A, but the community writ large, as the unsung heroes of our communities, because they serve, and the only time they usually hear feedback is when something's wrong.
Their feedback is,
or I want it quicker.
Yeah,
or it's wrong.
Their feedback so much is silent; they just don't come back. I didn't enjoy the experience.
Right, you're right. And it's a passive. Yep.
Yeah,
there's a passive mode.
I know when I was in retail, and that's why I'm on retail's working. We focused on demand, so we had to know when somebody came in and couldn't find what they wanted. If you didn't approach them and say and jot down this is what the person looking for, maybe it's not in our business plan, but at least we know.
Yeah,
but. You take the example of Sears U.S. was a catalog. And you went to the catalog, they understood all day long what people are looking for. Mm-hmm. Well, some idiot killed the catalog, okay? So the Sears is going to be gone before you and I are gone, probably. It's almost gone already. Sears in Canada still has the catalog because they serve those rural districts. 80% of all the people in Canada are within 25 miles of the border of the United States and probably work in the United States or a company that's based there. Mm-hmm. But the other 20% are in the hinterlands, and that's what the catalog serves.
Yeah.
So now when you get to online retail, you're back to having a catalog, and that's what I was working with J. Crew. They had the Sticks and Bricks operations. They had an internet presence already, but they didn't have as much knowledge of people cross-shopping the channels. So they actually had a catalog, too, which I don't think anybody calls it a catalog anymore. It's just it's a content management system that tracks demand.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see people looking and can track what they're looking for, you then can build more. We used to say, and the guys that we had 18 segments in SAP, and they used to say, the guys that did the meat processing, it was, okay, Sully, 87 hamburger, kill another cow. It was the kind of business it was in. You just had to have enough meat when that 100th hamburger got sold.
Mm-hmm.
And retailing's not so far off, but you're depending on other supply chains.
Yeah.
The cow's not hanging in the freezer already.
Right, right.
So I understand where you're coming from. That's an amazing.
Yeah.
So what I was up against with SAP was they gave you a year to do 2 years worth of work. And if you succeeded, they kept you. So it took 2 years to sell a thing this big, and they only gave you a year to do it. If you're getting close, you might have extended out. And I was lucky enough that we did get it done, but I strategically went upwards, and I said, I need somebody who knows this project. I need somebody from Germany here. We would bring people in from all over the world to do presentations.
Yeah.
A normal company or a company of less consequence couldn't. So I see where you're coming from. This is amazing.
Yeah, and I'm excited.
So when do you think your first real...
I don't know. I'm praying with every engagement. I'm praying that, you know, they get the question mark in their head and they're like, let me call, or hey, let me reach out to that website and take a look, or let me read Eric's blog. So
will you engage with an audit firm in order to do implementations, or you guys do it on your own?
No. So I'm not necessarily constrained to to the restaurant industry, even. If there's a small business man or woman out there that is listening and, you know, is taking an interest, you know, you can visit strategicleadersacademy.com. I've got a blog there. It's weekly, and so you can check that out. Chris also is a prolific writer, so he puts some really good stuff on there. You know, you can also find me Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter. It's at Cobra Strat Lead. And you know, I'm putting everything out there, and I think it's looking really optimistic. So
once again, this is Joe Peters, who you know, but Eric Culver, Kober, Strategic Leaders Academy. I put Leadership Academy, and you go somewhere else in the internet. So strategicleadersacademy.com.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to talk to Eric, you could reach him at 254-535-9549. I'm going to do a follow-up with you in about 30 days where we go a step deeper and maybe get your partner or hire, whatever you want to call them, your team leader involved. Because this has been an amazing conversation. I mean, just the fact that it flew by in 50 minutes is quick says a lot. Yeah. Eric, thank you for coming on. I'm going to play my commercial one more time, and next week
I will be on with the mayor of Clinton Township and the mayor of Clinton, two towns that play really good together. I heard them talk out affordable housing recently. I'm on the board of realtors for Hunterdon and Somerset and Mercer. And since then, I asked them to come on, but not just limit it to affordable housing. Eric, anything before we leave?
No, I just want to thank you for the opportunity.
Great.
And look forward to talking to everybody when they give a call.
Well, thanks for tuning in. And once again, Eric's number, 254-535-9549. Mine's coming right up. Thanks for tuning in. See you guys next week with the two mayors.
One of the biggest decisions in your lifetime is buying or selling a house. Choosing a realtor with strong client communication, technology, and marketing skills will dramatically improve your chance of success. That's why Hunterdon and Somerset's residents rely on Joe Peters. Joe believes his clients deserve a smooth and seamless experience, not a roller coaster ride. As a Coldwell Banker sales associate with 20 years of experience, he's helped hundreds of people to achieve their goals and dreams, no matter where they were in the buying or selling process. Joe accomplishes this by approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, he tries to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them his own. Then he takes the mass amount of data that's available and distills it down to a few understandable action points. And finally, he controls the entire process through technology and marketing. The end result to you is a smooth, rewarding customer experience. Let Joe show you how to take his professional expertise and put it to work for you. To contact Joe, go to jpeters.com or call 908-238-0118.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
President Trump says recession. What recession?
We're right now the number one country anywhere in the world by far as an economy.
Speaking at the White House on Tuesday, President Trump says he thinks the word recession is inappropriate and claims the media just likes to use it. The president also says he's considering possible tax cuts.
We're talking about indexing, and we're always looking at the capital gains tax, payroll tax.
Actor Jussie Smollett will have to wait a little bit longer to hear if the city of Chicago's lawsuit against him will proceed. Today, a federal judge postponed making a decision until October. The city is suing the former Empire actor for $130,000 to be reimbursed, money is spent investigating a fake hate crime. Your final numbers on Wall Street for Tuesday, the Dow lost 173 points, NASDAQ fell 54, S&P lost 23. This is USA Radio News.
It is a horrible scenario, but it happens. Dennis writes about his wife. She was diagnosed with leukemia. In fact, she's a two-time survivor, and in the midst of all that, they ran up over $1 million in medical bills. Thankfully, they're Medishare members, and Dennis says they are so thankful for that, how others came together to meet their needs. And that's how so many Medishare members feel. This is not health insurance. It's different. You don't have to pay for things you don't believe in. And like Dennis found out, it just works. So if you join Medishare, not only do you save a lot of money, the typical family saves about $500 a month, but you know where your money's going each month. You're helping people, and if the time should come, they'll be helping and even praying for you. So yes, it's different, and as more than 400,000 people now know, when it comes to healthcare costs, different is beautiful. Find out more. Call 833-34-BIBLE. That's 833-34-BIBLE. 833-34-BIBLE.
Turning now to political news, one 2020 Democratic presidential hopeful's wife has a message for everyone. As we hear from USA Radio Network's Chris Barnes in Washington.
You know, you may like another candidate better, but you have to look at who is going to win.
The latest endorsement for former Vice President and now White House hopeful Joe Biden comes from his wife, Dr. Jill Biden, who tells reporters in Manchester, New Hampshire.
But you've got to look at who's going to win this election. And maybe you have to swallow a little bit and say, okay, I sort of personally like so-and-so better. But your bottom line has to be that we have to beat Trump.
And Mrs. Biden says that her husband is the most likely candidate to beat President Trump in the 2020 election.
The National Park Service says starting Wednesday, Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House is set to close for 7 months for the construction of a new security fence. And you're listening to USA Radio News.